Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. A listener note, this episode contains references to adult content and language and contains material that some might find offensive. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. Like many comedians, Lenny Bruce started his career telling traditional jokes. In the early 1950s, he could be heard on the radio doing celebrity impressions. But as the decade wore on, Bruce grew tired of doing the same old shtick. Post-war America elevated traditional values. The country laughed to shows like I Love Lucy and Father Knows Best. Bob Hope, the biggest comedian at the time, was anything but edgy. But Bruce saw a different America than the one portrayed in the mainstream. He was a fan of the Beat Generation, a group that rejected propriety, embraced sex, drugs, and jazz. Soon, Bruce would weave all those things into his act, and comedy would never be the same. He delivered scathing monologues against people and institutions the nation held sacrosanct, religion, the role of women, even abortion laws. Critics called him a sick comic, clubs refused to book him, and his act also got him in trouble with the law. Bruce was arrested 15 times in less than 2 years, often for obscenity. But after a comedy club sting in 1964, Bruce faced the trial of his lifetime. And it wasn't just Bruce on trial, it was the future of free speech in America. Today we talk to Brett Gary about that trial. He's an associate professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. Here's our conversation. Brett Gary, welcome to American Scandal.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Before we talk about Lenny Bruce the man, I want to talk about the America he was performing in. It's a very different country than it is today. It's the, in many ways, we think of this time as the Leave It to Beaver 50s America, but that clearly wasn't where Lenny Bruce was coming from. So can you characterize America and Lenny Bruce's America for us to set the stage?
Sure. Lenny was operating in the subterranean spaces of 1950s America. And I think part of what he's doing is he's arguing against and critiquing the dominant culture, a kind of culture of consensus around family, marriage, Christianity, heterosexuality, kind of the reverence for the government, reverence for the military, reverence for religious officials. So all of those things were kind of objects of mockery or scorn for him. And I think that, you know, one of the things he's paying attention to is the deeply racist elements in the society, the suppression of homosexuality or the repression of it, the kind of absence of a free speech tradition that certainly concerns him. And I think that he's really concerned that there's kind of an absence of a sustained critique that's really available to the public about calling into question the hypocrisies of the dominant culture, the way in which official speech is polite speech. So he has a kind of sustained argument with the culture. And I think he also has a kind of sustained argument with its sort of overwhelmingly Christian dimensions, right? As a kind of wild Jew on the margins. He's really attentive to the way in which the kind of overarching themes and emphases in the culture are really kind of Christian in their frameworks.
So you mentioned that he was reacting to an absence of sustained critique. He certainly brought that sustained critique in his style of humor. When he inaugurated his style, when he finally found himself in nightclubs, how was he received by audiences?
One of the things that's interesting about him is that he finds his style in strip clubs. Before he makes his way into nightclubs, he's the MC in strip clubs in LA. And in those spaces, anything went. So he could say the most outlandish things, really provocative. He could play to his audience, which was an audience that was not a, you know, sort of rarefied audience. So it was a kind of, in the language of the time, it was a kind of low clientele, right? And a kind of low brow forms. And he spoke to that and he developed a style and he realized that those audiences responded. And he took that style and he took his shtick and his critique into nightclubs. And then he found that people responded very strongly to it. They appreciated his astute observations about the culture, his play with language, his use of vulgarity. He was not afraid of the vernacular. He used vulgar words. He talked about sex. He talked about masturbation and oral sex and homosexuality. And so those audiences who came to the nightclubs often, you know, which were still kind of marginal spaces, they were there for that. They were very interested in hearing Dirty Lenny or, you know, Lenny the Sicko. They knew what they were getting, or they knew what they'd hoped to get. So they were attracted to that space. But I think that that's an important part of the Lenny story, too, is that he is operating in these kind of marginal cultural spaces that don't have the kind of protection around them that, say, the print culture has, that the book publishing industry has, or that the film industry has, or that universities have. He's in operating in spaces that are much more vulnerable to surveillance. They're much more vulnerable to police raids. They're much more vulnerable to vice squads. That makes them edgy spaces, and the audience go there for their edginess, and they're rewarded for going there. But his provocations are observed as well.
Well, let's talk about his provocations, his vulgarity, and especially his relationship with obscenity. You know, he started in strip clubs and was clearly very close to this line in society. Let's listen to a clip from one of Lenny Bruce's sets in which he addresses specifically the word obscenity.
You know the meaning of obscenity, don't you? Perhaps you don't. See, if I do a disgusting show, we'll use any disgusting word. I'm just going to be talking about pork. That's my right, you see, as an American citizen, to discuss pork on stage. Although disgust, all of you vegetarians and Jews and Muslims, that is my right. And if you communists would like to suppress that right to talk about ham and pork, that's your right. Now, if I do a vulgar show, I sing rock and roll tunes. Just in the most vulgar form, with a big bulbous nose, that is not obscene. Obscenity has one specific meaning: to appeal to the prurient interest, to get you horny. That's what obscenity means. Yes. See, if that's why strippers get arrested for being obscene. They come out and they do a horny dance. The viewer gets horny and rapes somebody who didn't see the show. That's why we have the laws.
So this word obscenity will be used against Bruce many times throughout his career. But rather than ignore it, like we just heard, he weaves it into his act. Getting in the head of Bruce for a moment, what do you think he felt was missing from comedy, even the broader public discourse at the time, that he embraces obscenity?
I think truthfulness about sex was part of it. That, you know, people are driven by these sort of profound urges, and they're not necessarily the urges that they're supposed to be driven by, right? Sort of people have perverse sex. So I think that's part of it. The kind of the social silences around sexuality, especially the kind of verbal silences around sexuality, is partly what he's getting at. And I think that what he seizes on, right, in this kind of, in his obsession with obscenity, is he's obsessing on the laws, the obscenity laws that are silencing this conversation about sexuality. So there's a kind of long history of obscenity laws being used to silence discussions about information, about ideas, about human sexuality, human desire, fantasy, arousal. And Lenny realizes that that's the very thing that he's up against. And increasingly, as he gets arrested and he becomes acquainted with obscenity law, then that becomes kind of central to his critique, his inquiry, his performance, is the kind of the problem of obscenity law and the way in which obscenity laws run up against the First Amendment. And so that becomes a real centerpiece of his performances, is riffing on obscenity law and its meanings, and then sort of testing out the words that are seen as being obscene or offensive or immoral or lewd, all of those kind of synonyms that define obscenity law. So he's really, he's provoking the law by using those words as part of his kind of query about it, or his reflections on an examination of obscenity law.
Let's review these obscenity laws. At this time, what were they and what were their purpose?
They've been around for a long time by the late 1950s. They're laws that are passed at both the federal level and the state levels in the late 19th century. The big federal law, the Comstock Act of 1873, becomes the blueprint for all of the different state obscenity laws. Actually, though, New York State's obscenity law was the blueprint for the Comstock law, but the kind of the federal law becomes the template for all of the state obscenity laws. And essentially, in the late 19th century, there's an explosion of more sexual materials after the Civil War. Kind of photography becomes cheaper, more easily reproduced. So there's the distribution of what are called French postcards, kind of early pornographic postcards. Print publications that are much more sort of about erotic materials become more widespread. And contraceptives and abortion are being used much more readily. There's a kind of steady decline of the birth rate of white middle class and upper middle class families. American women, especially of the upper classes and middle classes, they're clearly using contraceptive devices. And so the obscenity laws, they curtail the flow of information about anything having to do with birth control and abortion, what the devices are, what the techniques are, what the technologies are, and also where they might be obtained. So all of those things are banned under the obscenity laws, and also any information or materials that are being seen as impure, lewd, lascivious, immoral, and that might lead to the arousal of lust. So the obscenity laws are sort of aimed at two things, right? They're sort of inhibiting lust, inhibiting the flow of materials that might lead to the arousal of lust, that might lead to the arousal of baser instincts, and then also information that might make contraception more easily available and more widespread. So from the late 19th century on, that becomes a really powerful censorship tool for federal authorities, postal authorities, customs authorities, and then also state authorities. So local police departments and vice societies and district attorneys in different cities use the obscenity laws as a way to crack down on people who are sort of printing dirty books or distributing pornography or selling stuff out of their secondhand bookstores or on magazine stands or selling condoms at barbershops or in dance halls and saloons. It's a kind of powerful weapon that's used to control the sexual. So the New York State that Lenny's prosecuted under in New York, but he's also prosecuted in San Francisco, he's prosecuted in Chicago, he's prosecuted in LA, right? All of the, for violating those states' obscenity laws. So New York State has sort of two different statutes on its book. That it's different. It's public law 1140 and it's public law 1141 are both kind of obscenity statutes aimed at kind of curbing obscene, indecent, impure entertainment in the case of the public law 1140, and then the kind of same thing for print materials. You know, one of the things that's interesting, right, is the birth control movement is up against these obscenity laws. Margaret Sanger's combating these obscenity laws. The publishing houses in New York and Boston and elsewhere are combating these obscenity laws. So that's the thing that keeps James Joyce's Ulysses unavailable to the American people until 1933. It's the thing that keeps Henry Miller's novel Tropic of Cancer is still successfully prosecuted as being obscene in New York State in 1963. So those laws have a long kind of continuous power as instruments for keeping sexual materials out of kind of the public sphere.
I'm curious, I think you use the present tense when describing the actual specific New York obscenity laws. Are they still enforced today?
Well, I think they could be enforced. I don't think they are. I don't believe in New York State that they have ever been overturned. It's just, it's much more difficult to enforce them at this point. But the federal obscenity laws are still in place. So, you know, in fact, in the late 1980s, the Helms Amendment in Senate extended the obscenity law to prohibit the use of federal monies for art that is obscene, lewd, immoral. So that, you know, one of in the big public art scandals of the late 1980s, the obscenity law is expanded, right? And says, all right, if you're going to use federal monies to exhibit art, it can't be art that is offensive, immoral, obscene, lewd, et cetera. And it really sort of targets the kind of art that's around the AIDS crisis in particular. So those laws are still on the books. It's just a matter of whether they're enforced or not. And getting prosecutions is much more difficult.
So these laws were a hindrance to Bruce immediately. And he didn't just walk the line. He deliberately crossed it. And question why line was even there. This provocation, this poking at the prevailing culture is probably an outgrowth of the beat movement of the time. Can you describe beat culture in the mid-50s as it was at the time of Lenny Bruce? And was he a part of this movement or did he just draw from it? Was he adjacent to it?
Oh, I think he was definitely adjacent to it. You know, the beat movement it's also about subterranean critique of the dominant culture, the kind of absence of authenticity in the dominant culture. It's part of the beat culture as a kind of search for euphoric moments. It's also, there's a kind of, you know, confluence of jazz stylings, jazz riffs, marijuana, you know, kind of Black American culture and Black American vernacular as being this sort of richer, more authentic tradition, and kind of space of sexual honesty, the suppression or the repression of queerness is certainly part of beat culture, right? That there is the need to acknowledge people's queer urges. I think that Lenny's drawing on all of this and he's participating in it. There's a flow back and forth. And his prosecution in San Francisco, he's found not guilty in San Francisco. And the lawyer who defends him had been the lawyer who defended Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti for the public reading of Allen Ginsberg's Howl at Ferlinghetti's City Lights bookstore in San Francisco. And so he's sort of in the tailwind of the beat culture, or he's drafting the beat culture, but he's part of it as well. He's part of the same kind of riffs and rhythms and critiques pointing to the same hypocrisies and also in search of a kind of truthfulness in the culture that the beats are trying to get after, kind of trying to liberate human beings from Eisenhower. Eisenhower's America, I think, is not inaccurate.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin Modern Classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. Much more recently, people might recognize the name Lenny Bruce because he is portrayed in the TV show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. In the show, Bruce is played by actor Luke Kirby, though some critics have said that he plays a sort of a fairy godmother equivalent of the real Lenny Bruce. You've watched the show. What do you think of his portrayal?
Well, he certainly looks like him. And I think, you know, he has kind of the same vocal quality. There is not that kind of fiery underground subterranean critic, I think, in that performance, and certainly not the junky Lenny Bruce, right? Lenny Bruce winds up arrested a lot for possession of drugs. He dies of a drug overdose, and you don't get that sense of Lenny as somebody who's sort of frayed, right? His nerves are frayed, his sensibilities are frayed. He's kind of peripatetic. It really inhibits his defenses, his legal defenses. So I think, you know, it's a very cleaned up version of Lenny Bruce. But though I must say, I have not watched beyond the second season to know where they've gone with Lenny Bruce as a character and whether he is, you know, sort of there is the kind of descent of Lenny into his sort of near madness. I think that's the thing about the Beats too, right? There is a kind of understanding of madness, right? That these sort of central Beat characters are, right? They're aware of madness. They're aware of their own kind of insanity. And that's part of their poetics.
Well, let's talk about the fiery underground junkie Bruce that might be missing from that characterization. Bruce continued to perform his brand of comedy into the 60s, but he was in and out of jail, being arrested for obscenity, and of course arrested for his addiction to heroin as well. At the same time, he was growing in fame, but then came his bust in the spring of 1964, a sting operation set up in Greenwich Village, the Cafe Go-Go. Can you describe this arrest for us? How was it set up?
Well, one of the things that Lenny was up against, right, is sort of ambitious district attorneys, ambitious prosecutors, and kind of angry white ethnic Catholic cops. He's, you know, when he's arrested in San Francisco, in L.A., in Chicago, and in New York, right, he's arrested by kind of politically ambitious prosecutors who want to get Dirty Lenny, right? And they send their cops into the clubs, and they watch his acts, and the cops become the kind of state's witnesses in his acts. So Richard Q in New York, he's running for mayor. And Frank Hogan, the assistant district attorney, Richard Q is the district attorney, they want to clean up New York. And so Lenny becomes this really kind of useful symbol, right, of the kind of smuttiness of New York, the dirt of New York that they want to go after and shut down. And so they send cops in to watch his shows at Cafe Agogo on three different occasions. And the cops accumulate this body of evidence about Lenny. And they sort of come back with these, you know, this is the kind of language that he's using. This is how he's talking about orgasms and body parts and his offensive language, right? His blasphemous and sacrilegious language. And so then the prosecutors are able to kind of mount an argument that he has kind of offended contemporary community standards and tastes. And that's part of the kind of the language of the obscenity law. And that he's also, because he's talking about sex and body parts, that he's also appealing to prurient interest. So the operation that sets him up is sting is kind of accurate, but it's just, they just send in the cops to watch him and they get evidence from his performances.
And that evidence is used in his trial, which was followed by many people, gained a lot of media attention. Celebrities attended and testified, Woody Allen, Norman Mailer.
Sociologists, others, right? There's 30 different witnesses.
So certainly it's a spectacle. and it begins to consume Lenny Bruce's life and enters his comedy routines as well. So I'm interested, for Lenny Bruce, what do you think he thought was at stake in his trial beyond just his freedom?
The First Amendment, right? He's really, he's very literal about the First Amendment, right? That he has this free speech, and the First Amendment ought to protect that right of free speech, and that obscenity law is obstructed. It obstructs the First Amendment, right? So there's this kind of collision between obscenity law and the First Amendment. And he thinks that the First Amendment, sort of purely understand, ought to protect his right to speech. And so that, for him, that kind of ability to stand up sort of naked in front of a microphone, in front of a group of people, and hold forth is a kind of fundamental guarantee and promised in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And so I think for him, that's really what's at stake. And then the kind of the right to be truthful, the right to be critical, stuff that would be protected in print is not necessarily protected when performed orally. And I think that he's kind of astonished that obscenity law is still effectively used to silence provocative speech, sexual speech, speech that offends. And he does give offense, right? And he's deliberately giving offense. So yeah, I think for him, it's like that. I think he thinks of himself as kind of a martyr for the First Amendment, and that's certainly how he's been received over time.
His trial in New York for you is a bit special because you, in your capacity as a professor, have reenacted, held mock trials for Lenny Bruce in your classes. I'm very curious about what the purpose of this exercise is for your students, and how did these trials go?
Well, they were fun to do. And I think, that, you know, the purpose was that in 1963, 1964 in New York, obscenity law is still very ambiguous, right? It is both the kind of decisions in the Supreme Court in the Roth case in 1957 and the Jacobellis case, right? They have kind of provided more space for speech that is sexual speech and that serves a kind of larger public interest. In the Roth case, that Supreme Court said that all ideas that have even the slightest redeeming social importance, right? Unorthodox ideas, hateful ideas even, are protected, right? But they're not protected. So there's protected speech, but then they're not protected if they're obscene, because obscene speech is not protected. So the court, it giveth and it taketh away. And then they have these tests, right? If it's to the average person applying contemporary community standards, if the dominant theme taken as a whole appeals to prurient interests, then it's obscene. And then the Jacobellis case a few years later sort of uses the language utterly without redeeming social interest. So the thing that I wanted my students to look at was, all right, is Lenny's speech, does it have redeeming social interest, or is it utterly without redeeming social interest? Does it offend contemporary community standards for the average person? And so I think what was rich about it is that they could look at Lenny's performances, and some can say, wow, that is really offensive. And others could say, yeah, but he's making this social argument. And they were not, and they really went back and forth, because his narratives, right? That was part of the problem was Lenny's performances is he riffed. And so they were kind of, they were broken stream of consciousness things. At certain points, he would just sort of break from one thought to the next. So it was very hard for him and for his lawyers to say there was a kind of sustained argument. So the taken as a whole thing was complicated. And so for the students, I think it was really interesting to see how that law, given its vagueness, could still be used to find him guilty of obscenity. And for those who wanted to defend him, they could say, no, his work really did have redeeming social interest. It spoke to, even if it wasn't cohesive, even if these weren't kind of cohesive, coherent arguments, there was enough in them that it was a kind of sustained critique that did have social interest. I think that's what the ambiguity of the law and how he could both stake out a successful defense and also how the prosecutors could successfully prosecute him was a rich way to look at how obscenity law functioned in the early 60s, right? Kind of on the verge of the 60s. that was pretty interesting. So I'd get students to perform Lenny, you know, the most creative and theatrical person would perform Lenny, and we'd have prosecutors, witnesses, a panel of judges, and they usually found him not guilty, but there was always a strong argument about his offensiveness.
But for Lenny Bruce, the real person, he was found guilty.
He was.
The three-judge panel, they convicted him of obscenity and sentenced him to serve 4 months, but he was not well-behaved during this trial. And I'm wondering if you think his guilty verdict came in any part because he interfered in his own defense.
He did. Lenny was not patient for the law, and he was not patient for his lawyers. And he kept firing lawyers. He didn't sustain lawyers from one trial to the next. He offended the judges. His kind of unwillingness to sit by and let his lawyers do their work, I think, really interfered with his defense. Because there was a body of argument by 1964 that his lawyers in Illinois had worked out. His conviction in Chicago was overturned by the Illinois Supreme Court. His successful defense in San Francisco, there was a kind of body of argument about his work that was available to the lawyers. And Lenny was just really impatient with his lawyers and interjected, interrupted.
And do you think that that affected his verdict?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no question. If he had been more patient and allowed his lawyers to do their work, they would have been able to marshal a defense that would have used the most recent rulings in the Supreme Court and in the Illinois Supreme Court as precedents to defend him. The owner of Cafe Agogo, he was also prosecuted, right? And this is kind of the thing about like the shrinking spaces for Lenny, is that the club owners could be prosecuted, or they could lose their licenses. One of the versions, or a kind of ancillary instruments that were used in the obscenity laws, is that New York State passed the Wales Act, or the Wales Padlock Law, that meant that like the city's commissioner of licenses could go in and shut down clubs where there was obscene materials being performed. And so the club owners were really vulnerable too, right? If the police were raiding their joints, they could lose their licenses. They could be hauled into jail as well. So Howard Solomon, who owned the Cafe Agogo, he was also successfully prosecuted, but then his conviction was overturned by an appellate court in New York. Essentially said that Bruce's performances did have social importance, right? That he was addressing serious problems and of religious hypocrisy and racial and religious prejudices, et cetera. And that argument was there. That's kind of legal framework was available. But Lenny, his impatience rate really, really hindered him. And then he was also, at the same time that he was being prosecuted in New York, he was in the courts in LA for jumping bail and for possession of heroin. So he's sort of flying back and forth between New York and LA. He's missing court dates. His heroin addiction really kind of overwhelmed him and made him sort of less able to focus.
It was ultimately that heroin addiction that led to his demise. He never served the 4 months he was sentenced. He appealed. He remained free on bail. But the shrinking spaces that you talk about forced him into a situation where he couldn't work. No club wanted to book him out of the fear they'd be dragged into a case themselves. And then in 1966, Lenny Bruce, well, he overdosed and died while working on that appeal. A curious fact, he left his typewriter on, and his last sentence typed ever was conspiracy to interfere with the Fourth Amendment, and we just won't know what that meant to him.
In his own mind, he'd become a kind of constitutional scholar, right? So he was thinking hard about these issues of the Bill of Rights.
And in fact, the nation, because of his trial, had to think hard about these issues. His trial and his efforts to bring forth these questions changed the nation in a way. I wonder, what do you think changed after Bruce's death, and what part did he play in that change?
Well, I think he opened up the space for comedians to be much more kind of ribald and provocative. much more willing to kind of challenge the cultural conventions, to challenge sort of assumptions about what constituted decency. So I think, you know, his kind of transformation of the comedy industry is huge. People like George Carlin, who like watched Lenny perform and then would open for Lenny, Dick Gregory, Richard Pryor. We wouldn't have Sarah Silverman and Amy Schumer, right, without Lenny Bruce. There's no question that he really paved the way for a different kind of comedic performance. But I, you know, I also think the fact that Lenny died as a junkie made him, kept him marginal, right? So the kind of critique that he offered up to the mainstream culture gets a little bit silenced as well by his death, because it becomes evidence that this guy was a kind of crazy person on the margins. And so I'm not sure that in the mainstream he transforms the culture that much. But I think that people who are operating as comedians and social critics, he becomes a really powerful, a kind of powerful symbol, a powerful voice, and then a kind of model who they emulate. And they slowly but steadily help transform the culture.
American Scandal is sponsored by the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Following one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British legal history, the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, is based on the shocking true story of the British Post Office scandal. When money started to seemingly disappear from local branches, the government-owned post office wrongly blamed their own managers for its apparent loss. And for more than a decade, hundreds were accused of theft and fraud. Many were even sent to prison, leaving lives, marriages, and reputations in ruins. But the issue was actually caused by errors in the post office's own computer system, something it denied for years. Don't miss Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, starring Toby Jones, beginning Sunday, April 7th on Masterpiece on PBS. The series will be available to stream on the PBS app, PBS Masterpiece Prime Video Channel, and PBS.org.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Let's talk about comedic culture today. Certainly we have a discourse, an ongoing discourse about cancel culture and what is appropriate for comedians to say or do. While obscenity laws may have fallen by the wayside and remain unenforceable, the social pressure is certainly rising. Last year, comedian Dave Chappelle faced a backlash for his Netflix special titled Sticks and Stones, after he shared some controversial opinions on topics like the Me Too movement or Michael Jackson and the transgender community. If the goal of obscenity laws was to prevent people like Lenny Bruce from corrupting the public, what would you say is the goal of online activists today?
That's a hard one. Well, it's there's a lot of attention to speech and ideas and arguments that give offense on the kind of online activist culture and cancel culture. So there's a kind of deep sensitivity to the antenna are really out there for speech that offends, ideas that offend, and kind of representation, right, is so critical. How are queer people represented? How are trans people represented? How are people of color represented? Who gets to say what about whom? And so I think there's a lot of patrolling and policing about speech that particular groups feel like is offensive to them. We're really in a moment of a kind of heightened awareness of that. Here's an example, which was so interesting to me. My students yesterday gave a presentation on the film Life of Brian from the late 1970s, 1979, by Monty Python. So the film is audacious, right? In so many ways, it takes a Jesus figure and kind of burlesques the Jesus figure, right? So that at the crucifixion scene is this just incredibly powerful image, idea, moment in history. At the Life of Brian, all of the different people on the, you know, who are on crosses, they're singing, you know, look on the bright side of life. And it's this incredibly cheeky sacrilege. So when my students were talking about it, like that part, they kind of could not admit that people would be offended by that. But what they did find offensive was that the Pontius Pilate character, who speaks with a lisp, right, is mocked by the people in the audience who are listening to him speech, right? And they're taunting him about his lisp. There's a moment in which one of the Brian's acolytes reveals to his fellow acolytes that he'd like to be a woman and he'd like to have a baby. And so there's this long riff, right, on his right to be, you know, kind of have a sex change and to have a baby. But the students found that kind of offensive. Even though they said it was progressive, it's still like not very, it's not sympathetic. And the lisp thing was ableist. And then in one of the kind of crowd scenes, there's somebody in blackface. And so that was just fascinating to me, that those were the issues that they seized upon. But the burlesquing of the crucifixion was like, oh, that, you know, I suppose that was offensive back then, but it's not now. So the kind of incredible secularization of the society, but then these other places of representation, right, that they see as, well, that was offensive, right, the kind of the use of the lisp. So I thought that was really fascinating and kind of suggests, right, how cancel culture works. If the dominant culture is being burlesqued, that's okay, because that's where the power resides, right? So, but people who are sort of less powerful, have less authority over institutions, if they are being misrepresented or burlesqued, then that's not okay. So I think there's a, you know, kind of shrinking space or humor's patrolled.
You mentioned that there's a disparity between what is able to be printed and what is able to be performed at this time. Why is there a difference?
A big difference is that the kind of institutional support, the institutional importance of, and the kind of legal history surrounding the protection of the publishing industries and the cultural value that's given to the printed word, the cultural value that's given to like serious novels, artistic novels, right, becomes part of the accumulating legal defense of literary expression. The spoken word in marginal spaces doesn't have any of that institutional support, right? And those are spaces, again, this kind of subterranean clubs and jazz clubs, those places get raided, right? They get raided. The musicians get arrested for possession of drugs. The licenses get taken away, right? They're already vulnerable spaces. And then, so then you have this sort of crazy man, right? Kind of brilliantly crazy, critical guy on the stage, that there's no kind of institutional mechanism that supports him. So he's really challenging an already very unsettled free speech tradition without the kind of undergirding of a institutional history and a legal history that protects that kind of speech. And I think that's an important thing, that the First Amendment is really unsettled in this period, right? Communist speech in the 1950s was illegal. It was illegal to be a member of the Communist Party. It was illegal to be distributing communist materials. It's not, you know, kind of the idea that we have this sort of always strong, always present First Amendment tradition is just not true. The First Amendment's really vulnerable in moments of crisis. And the kind of Cold War crisis doesn't even, you know, sort of extend to protecting radical speech. So Lenny's producing radical speech in another venue, right, in a kind of in another arena, but he's also then running up against obscenity law. So he has neither the First Amendment as a kind of certain guarantor of his speech, right? And then he's running up against this very powerful, still operative obscenity law mechanism that makes his speech very, very problematic, right? It's not necessarily protected by the First Amendment.
Brett Gary, thank you for coming on American Scandal.
Very happy to have had the chance to talk with you. Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Brett Gary, associate professor in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. Next on American Scandal, the Branch Davidians were a small religious group based outside Waco, Texas. In the early 1990s, the group's potential illegal activities caught the attention of the federal government, leading to a long standoff and a bloody conflict. The resulting tragedy opened the door to questions about religious freedom in America and the federal government's use of force on its own citizens. From Wondery, this is episode 3 of 3 of Lenny Bruce for American Scandal. In our next series, the Branch Davidians were a small religious group based outside Waco, Texas. In the early 1990s, this group's potential illegal activities caught the attention of the federal government, leading to a long standoff and a bloody conflict. The resulting tragedy opened the door to questions about religious freedom in America and the federal government's use of force on its own citizens. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound designed by Derek Behrens. This episode was produced by Austin Cross. This series on Lenny Bruce was written by Hannibal Diaz, edited by Christina Malzberger, produced by Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.